good evening, and welcome to Ubuntu Podcast, Season 14, Episode 23. It's Tuesday, the 10th of August, and this week's show will be full of community news and big boy news and other conversational stuff. If you want to get in touch with us, maybe for some feedback for next week's episode, then send us an email to show@ubuntupodcast.org or drop by our Telegram channel. Go to ubuntupodcast.org/telegram. So this week, Martin is allowed a holiday, apparently.
Shocking.
And so this week, I'm only here with Mark as a regular presenter. Hello, Mark.
Only? I mean, hi, Alan.
Hello. And we're joined by glorious guest presenter from Welsh Wales, Rhys. Hello, Rhys.
Hello, both.
Rhys is on the community team at Canonical, working on something called Ubuntu or something.
Ubuntu?
Yes. And so I think we should probably talk more to Rhys about that kind of thing in next week's episode.
That sounds like a good idea.
This week, let's find out what you've been up to, Rhys. What have you been doing this week?
Well, what have I been doing this week? This was one of my favourite questions to be asked, because it means I don't know what I've been doing for the past week. But what I have been doing this week is I've been playing using the Steam thing called Tabletop Simulator.
And what have you been playing with Tabletop Simulator?
Oh, an excellent question. I've been playing a couple of things with an old pal of mine. We've been playing Marvel Champions, if you've seen that one.
No.
Is that the deck-building game?
You do build decks, but the focus, I guess it is a deck-building game.
I think I might have played it.
Oh, yeah? And you collaborate with other Marvel heroes against a Marvel villain, and it's all good fun.
Yeah, I think I've played that IRL.
Oh, all right, show off. So we've been that, and I played Gloomhaven. We've been playing a little bit of the intro games to Gloomhaven, which has been fun.
Cool. How does Tabletop Simulator work? Do you just pay for the Tabletop Simulator and then the games are free, or do you have to pay for each game you play?
It's actually the other way around. Yes. Tabletop Simulator's free. And then you pay for each of the games.
Yes, or you download them off Steam Workshop and hope that they don't get pulled by DMCA requests.
No. We buy games.
You pay all the games legitimately, even the ones that you own the physical version of.
Exactly.
Yes.
On that bombshell, Mark, what have you been up to this week?
I have been enjoying Doom Eternal.
Ah, is that a tabletop game?
No, it's not. It's the game which I spoke about having trouble installing before.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
It's a shooty-shooty bang-bang kind of game, isn't it?
It is, and also a bit of a 3D platformer in places as well. But I was getting a bit frustrated with it, and I think the problem was I had the difficulty set too high, so I toned it down a bit. And now I can play it much easier, but I now find it's a bit too low. I kind of find that I get through the big battles and then I've still got loads of health and ammo left. And I kind of feel like I should get to the end of the big battles and just scrape through. But there doesn't seem to be a setting for that for me. I either can't do it at all or I can do it really easily.
Does it have the same thing as the old Doom where the first one is, you know, be nice daddy and you have a dummy in?
Yes.
Right.
It sounds like you've been improving, though, even if you've lowered the difficulty, because other listeners like I will have known that you've mentioned Doom Eternal a couple of times before.
Yeah. I've stuck with it. I didn't just rage quit. I'm kind of feeling like I waited till it was in the sale because I didn't think that I would get 50 quid's worth of gaming out of it. And I'm beginning to feel that that was the right decision. I kind of feel like once I played through it, I'm not going to go back and up the difficulty and try and beat it again because I'll just get stuck in all the same places. But we'll see what happens. Maybe I'll tell you in a couple of weeks' time.
Yeah, report back on a future episode.
On the Doom Eternal podcast.
Right, let's get on with the show. And first up, we have some community news. And first in the community news, Launchpad now runs on Python 3. So this is everyone's favorite code hosting repository. No, not that one. Launchpad is now running on Python 3. It was Python 2, but it's been migrated to Python 3. Now, why is this important? Well, that in itself isn't especially important. But what I love are the blog posts that the engineers who are working in the boiler room write about these open source projects. And Colin Watson has published a new blog post, which is a follow-up to a previous one about this migration. And it's worth a read, as all of Colin's posts are. It's, you know, full of detail and, you know, the gotchas that he encountered along the way. It's worth a read.
Yeah, it's one of those things that sort of rumbles on in the open source community for several years when something like this, there's like a major uplift in a thing lots of people use, and you get people just saying, oh no, we'll just keep supporting the old way, or we'll port this entire thing over so that our project doesn't have to upgrade. But eventually everyone has to move. And even if you've got a big project with lots of parts like Launchpad, I mean, you know, there are distributions which I don't think that the current version of Ubuntu supports Python 2 still, does it?
Supports as in it's in the repository, but it's not, but it's shipped not, by right, default right. on the CD.
But yeah, it's getting dropped. There's soon not going to be options to run Python 3 on certain distros. Python 2 on certain distros. So, you know, it has to be done, but it's a painful process in a lot of cases. So it's good to see it happening for a big project like this.
I wonder if anyone actually noticed. Like, it's one of those infrastructure things that, you know, it doesn't have a big 3 logo in the corner.
Yeah, you don't get lots of flashy new end user features. You just get to keep running the software.
Yeah, I've got three snakes slithering around all of a sudden.
Yes. Yes. Much better than two snakes slithering around all over the screen. Awesome. What's next, Mark?
Unity X has been launched. It's the successor to Unity 7. It's a new desktop environment, which is designed to provide some of the classic Unity features we know and love, but in a modern desktop environment.
I love Unity 7, just like the next man. And I love the idea of keeping the dream alive. And whenever people mention Unity 7, I feel like all it needs is just a little polish, a little spit and polish, and a little makeover and a little freshen up, and it'll be fine. I didn't know it needed a complete rewrite. Given that Canonical did that like 4 times already in varying languages. So, I mean, at least they're keeping with the spirit in which it was created.
Yeah. But yeah, I've not actually tried this out. I'm not sure how easy it is to get running at the moment. But it's, you know, it's kind of trying to implement the things like the dash and the HUD and those sort of Unity-specific things. But yeah, whether we're going to see this as the new desktop for the Ubuntu Unity Edition to replace Unity 7, time will tell.
It'll be interesting to see if some of the newer the small tablets, like the, what was the one that came out recently, the Jingpad, that's what A1, I meant to say. I wonder if it'll run on that kind of thing. Interesting if it's catering to the new hardwares.
I did read something about it being aimed at keyboard users, though, which I always felt. People always said, oh, Unity 7, it's for touchscreens, but I always felt it was for keyboards, and I was a heavy keyboard user on it.
Given the fact that the first time you launched Unity 7, it would punch you in the face with a giant list of keyboard shortcuts. it really wasn't designed for touch. It's this big misnomer for all desktop environments that have large icons. People seem to think large icons equals tablet, and there's no convincing some people of otherwise. Hey-ho. Well, we'll have to keep an eye on that and hope it progresses, and maybe someone can run it up and give us some feedback on what it runs like. What's next, Reese?
KDE have made an advert.
Gosh.
Ooh.
I know. The KDE project tried to imagine what an advert for a KDE application, KDE thing would look like. They made one for a really nice one, I think, for console. It's got a friendly old man with a grey beard using a laptop running KDE. The voiceover is really nice. It reminisces a little bit. And the production quality in general is just... it's just very good. And it makes it all warm and fuzzy, you know? It's a good ad.
Yeah, I mean, I would never have imagined doing an ad for a terminal emulator, but they've done it. They did quite a good job of it.
Well, to be fair, Microsoft did. When they launched their new terminal a couple of years ago or so, they did a really flashy one with 3D and, you know, lovely transparent effects. And I left a comment under the video on YouTube. I was like, incredulous that why am I enjoying watching this video over and over again from Microsoft, of all people, advertising a terminal emulator. And every so often I rewatch that video and see my stupid comment underneath it.
Yeah, but this is part of a project, isn't it? This isn't a one-off. They're doing several adverts for different applications as part of was it KD Discover project or something?
Oh, I think so.
I found it interesting that Paul from the KDE promotions team fessed up on how they made it It's stock footage from Pexels. The guy, yeah, he's just stock footage of a guy sat on a sofa, and the voiceover isn't even him. It's someone else from Fiverr.
Wow.
That place where you can get cheap voiceovers. And they smooshed it all together with a few short clips of console. Like, there's your advert.
Do you think they did it in KDN Live? Brilliant.
I'm going to go armed with that information tomorrow, because as soon as I saw it, I let a bunch of colleagues at Canonical know and say, hey, we should do these. So maybe if it's that easy.
Yeah, it only cost us $15.
Yeah.
I thought it was great. It's lovely. I'm interested to know what the rest of them are going to be like and whether they can maintain this high standard. We shall see. Next up, Yo-Yo Games, creators of GameMaker Studio 2, a popular tool with indie game devs, have made a Linux build of their studio product.
Ooh.
Mm. This is always good, isn't it? More software for Linux.
Yeah.
So Yo-Yo, I didn't realize, were bought by Opera, the browser people, back in January. And what they've done is take their game development tool and they've ported it to Linux so that you can create games on Linux. Now, it's only beta quality at the moment. It has a giant list of things that do not work and things that cause it to crash. But I find it super interesting because this has not been available for Linux for a very long time. And GameMaker Studio is popular among indies and people just getting started with game development. So yeah, I was quite pleased to see this. You know, we've got Unity, we've got Godot, we've got all kinds of game development tools, and now we've got GameMaker Studio on Linux as well.
How have you used it? How does it compare to that one that Martin, who's on holiday, uses?
It's very good. It's I had to use it recently in order to monkey around with a game that already existed that Martin had made into a snap, and there was something wrong with it. And so the source code was available. So I loaded the source code into GameMaker Studio, but on Windows, and monkeyed around with it and rebuilt a new version. But this is interesting because it would enable me to load the source code for the game on Linux and build for Linux on Linux. Because at the moment you can build for Linux using GameMaker Studio, but what you have to do is do it on a Windows machine in GameMaker Studio for Windows, and then hook it up to a VM running Ubuntu, and it SSHs into the Ubuntu machine and does all the build and then pulls the binary out afterwards and then says, there you go, there's your Linux binary. It's quite wacky and quite cumbersome to set up. So I'm not surprised most people don't bother, but this will make it super easy. You just do it directly on your Linux workstation.
Excellent.
Yeah. And is this commercial or is this free?
It's commercial. There is a free tier. I don't think you can get it on the free tier. You have to get the beta version or something. You have to opt in to like insiders or betas or something. But they've actually also just changed their pricing model. It was pay once and you get GameMaker Studio, and they've changed it. It's now subscription model. Mm-hmm. They just announced that today, and it's had a bit of flack because, you know, a lot of companies are moving to the subscription model.
Yeah.
So it's at like $80 a year for indies and something like $600 for enterprise version. And the difference is which export tools you get, whether you can export for mobile or game consoles and stuff like that.
Interesting.
Mm. Speaking of money, Mark.
Flatpak wants your money.
Ooh.
They've joined Open Collective in order to basically have a platform to enable users and members of the community to contribute funds to help fund, presumably, development and cover costs and all those things that open source projects have.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, Flatpak is mostly maintained by people who work at Red Hat. Okay, there is haters are going to like contact me and tell me there's a community. But, you know, the main like two or three people worked at Red Hat. They were paid by Red Hat to work on this stuff. And one of them has moved on and now works on automotive stuff and doesn't work on Flatpak.
Interesting.
And so I wonder if it's a coincidence that, you know, generating funds is a way to pay community people to work on it, which is a great thing to do. I'm not knocking it, but it's a weird coincidence that those two things happen around about the same time.
Yeah. But yeah, it's interesting to see. Yeah. Open Collective, I think, is one of these organizations that means that they don't have to go through the sort of rigmarole of setting up their own company and working out how to sort out money without getting done for tax fraud and so on. So it's like a ready-made platform for open projects to be able to...
Like an umbrella.
Yeah,
kind of.
To be able to do this sort of thing quite easily.
And have they had some donations already?
It looks like it. There are 52 contributors at the time of writing. each contributing anywhere between $5 and $1,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very interesting. I'm very excited to see the result of this. I wonder if they'll publish any sort of how it's going kind of thing, because it could be a lovely another lovely arrow in the quiver of maybe getting something like this for Snaps in the Snap Store at some point.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. And that's all the community news for this week. And now time for some news from the wider tech world. First up, Reese, what's next?
This is something that I saw this week, and it's that Linux has hit 1% of the Steam user base. That's Linux hit the steamy 1% mark. apparently, it's not the first time Linux has done this, and it's been going up and down around the 1% mark for a while. Uh-huh. But around April time, it crossed the threshold and has stayed above it. So it's worth noting.
We're here to stay.
Hopefully we're here to stay.
I like being part of the 1%. It's the bottom 1%.
Yeah, the bottom 1%. The data comes from their own sort of Steam tracker tool, but I think it just pulls from Valve's own numbers and stuff like that.
Right. So I guess this is when you get the little survey pop up and say, tell us about your computer, and you respond. Yeah. And everyone who's on Linux and sees that says, yes, I finally got it.
Exactly. Well, so that's the interesting part, because Valve say that they look at the client that's used to purchase the game when you purchase the game.
Oh, okay. Right.
It's said in the article, so maybe I'm misunderstanding, but it's said in the article that they then look at the data that the game sends back on what it's being played on.
Yeah.
And this is because you can buy Steam games on Android or web, which means that they're set to Windows for Valve's metrics. And so if you want your Linux gaming to count towards the statistics, if you bought it on Android or web, you have to then play it on your Linux machine within the next 2 weeks to count for the steamy 1%.
Yes. I think it's really interesting that people have actually reached out to Valve and said, how do I make sure that my Linux purchases count in your statistics? Like, mm-hmm. there's people who are really keen to ensure that this is visible to Valve. And, you know, I guess that actually the fact that people then go and talk to Valve about it makes it, you know, they pay attention, I guess, and they let people know that, you know, there are ways to make sure.
They definitely are paying attention, because the Valve official figures say that about 120 million users is the total sort of user share. And that means 1% of that is 1.2 million Linux gamers bi-weekly.
Nice.
Interesting, huh?
I just, that doesn't feel like a lot. I feel like that number should be higher. Okay, it might be 10 million and, you know, 90% of them aren't playing most of the time. Mm. And, you know, it's because, you know, you're busy doing other stuff, working or at college or whatever. So it's entirely plausible, but I don't know, that number feels too small.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about what they've said about how it's counted, if you're someone who dual boots, or you maybe have a main Windows gaming PC and do a bit of your gaming on Linux, you use that for other things and do a bit of casual gaming there, probably most of your stuff is going to count towards Windows. Like, I suspect that most people who game on Linux aren't like me, where that's your only setup.
Right. Well, clearly no. Because 99% of people are like that, apparently.
On the other hand, when the Steam Deck comes along, we might find that shift goes further the other way.
That will be interesting to see, yeah.
That was part of the speculation, because around April time was when the Steam Deck was sort of announced or was talked about for the first time, these kind of things. Mm. And so they think that might have... Maybe people are trying to make their own Steam Decks and doing it this way. I don't know. It's an interesting... I wonder where the numbers are coming from.
I love that everyone speculates about the numbers. Like, the last time Linux went down, there was speculation that there were suddenly lots more Windows users in China, suddenly a whole load of more Windows users. So proportionally, that pushed down the Linux average. And yeah, it may well be true. I don't know. But I love that people like try and like do the math, as they say, in order to figure out. Well, we'll have to keep an eye on that one. And maybe when we get to next year, next season, maybe we'll hit 2% thanks to Steam Deck.
2%?
Yeah. Next up, the Amiga lives. Another year passes and it's time to tickle the retro glands with a new mini console. Ooh. And this time it's the Commodore Amiga that gets the Shrinkotron treatment. So, you know, we've seen lots of these little mini consoles, the mini NES, mini SNES, the little Game Gear and all the others. And next up, it's the venerable Commodore Amiga.
Yeah, this is the A500, my first computer.
Was it really?
Wow. Yeah.
Gosh. So interestingly, you are basically target market for this thing, because
I am.
This is like 30 years on from when the Amiga came out or something like that. My benchmark is, you know, people with a disposable income 30 years after the thing comes out is a good time to re-release that thing or create a new version of that.
You're assuming
thing.
I have disposable income.
Well, yes, there is that.
I did just have a child.
Yes. So would you buy one of these things?
It's tempting. I mean, I've had a quick look at the article about it, and the list of games that they've announced so far is, you know, it's looking very promising. It's the games that I'd want to see, you know, especially a lot of them are, because we bought a lot of Amiga magazines. So a lot of the games I played were from cover discs, which often meant they were the demos. And, you know, we had two big floppy disk boxes, which we'd rifle through and, you know, you'd stick a game in and you'd play it for half an hour and you'd get to the end of the demo and you'd chuck it out and get a new one and, you know, spend half an hour waiting for it to load and so on. But, you know, a lot of the games which are showing up on that list are things that, like, I played the demo of when I was a kid and I really liked, but I had enough other demos that I wasn't particularly bothered about not having the full game. But, you know, So that kind of makes me think, oh yeah, I could get that and play all those games. But then also I think, do I actually want to spend £100 to play some Amiga games when I could buy some modern games and play them on my Steam Deck, which I'm also about to fork out a load of money for.
So I feel like we should, for young Reese, we should explain the cover disc on a magazine.
Not just for young Reese, but for your younger audience,
all of them, yeah. all five of them who happen to be listening next to their parents.
just like I am right now.
Hi Reese's mum and dad, thanks for coming along tonight.
So yeah, it's one of those things that I think if it triggers your retro, you know, gland, then you probably might get one. I probably won't, just because I never had an Amiga. I lusted after them and my mates had them, but I never had one. Reese, have you ever heard of an Amiga?
You know, I think I have heard of it, but I'm almost certain the only reason I've heard of it is because of you and Martin.
Oh, good. So yeah, it's actually made by the same people who made the C64 Mini that Martin keeps wearing on about. The Retro Games Limited, who they had quite some success with those C64 Minis. The packaging was good. It looked very much in the same style as the original Commodore 64. The joysticks looked robust and people seem to be, on the whole, very positive about the stuff they've done. So it seems like it could be in good hands. It's currently a bit vaporware. You know, it doesn't actually exist yet. It's out next year.
Yeah. And it's quite a neat learning thing as well, because, you know, the Amiga was like an all-in-one computer minus the, you know, you plugged in a monitor, or in our case, you plugged in a TV, but it's like a big, it's kind of like the Raspberry Pi 400, but massive. So it's like a keyboard with a computer strapped to the back and underneath. And so this thing is like a miniaturized version. So it's got a mini keyboard. I don't think it's functional, but it's like, you know, a little case with a keyboard on top. It's very cute.
Mm. I'm trying to do a quick search and it looks like the Nintendo 64 came out. I wonder what will happen in 35 years' time after 1996, which is when the 64 came out. I wonder if any of those nostalgia glands will hit me then, because this is doing nothing for me.
Right. Well, exactly. So that's the thing. The NES came out, then the SNES, the mini SNES, and the next logical one after that would be the N64, right? Mm. But the jump from the SNES to the N64 in terms of computation is the same kind of jump from like the early consoles, like the Genesis up to the PlayStation 1. It's emulation and the FPGAs and the ARM chips that can emulate the below the N64 are 10 a penny. But emulating something just above that requires a bit more power. And I think they get to the price point where it's too much. Mm. I think if they wanted to make an N64, you would have to wait a couple of years for the price point to be reasonable. Otherwise, it's going to be like ludicrous money. for something which you could pick up on eBay for 50 quid or go in my loft and find three of them.
I'll take you up on that.
Which you can't, you don't want to go in my loft, trust me. Next up, Mark.
The Framework laptop has been torn apart by iFixit.
Oh, no, that's a good thing, right.
Yeah, they very much enjoyed tearing it apart. So iFixit are a website that do sort of repair guides and tear down guides for electronics and give stuff. If you're looking to buy something, you can go there quite often and find out how repairable it is if you wanted to replace parts yourself. And they also sell tools for doing the job. And they got hold of a Framework laptop, which we've discussed on the show before. It's a laptop which is designed with replaceability and repairability in mind, and also has these customizable ports on the side so that you don't, it doesn't come with a fixed set of ports. You can choose what you need for your use case. So they got the DIY edition, which is, the original idea was that basically you'd get a build your own laptop kit. It sounds like that hasn't quite come through yet. Basically, they got the bare bones machine and the upgradable parts they could put in themselves, which is still quite nice, and attach the ports themselves. But the real cool thing is they gave it 10 out of 10 on repairability, which is something they very rarely do. They, like, watching the video and going through and seeing them take it apart, it's absolutely just brilliant. It looks lovely inside, and like there's all sorts of nice little touches. Like, there's, you know, you only have to take undo 5 screws underneath, and the screws are captive so they don't fall out. They stay in the case while you're taking it apart, so you can't lose things. And there's, the screen bezel is held on by magnets, so if you want to replace it or it gets broken, you can just, you know, ease it off and it comes away without you having to like unstick glue. Or yeah, nothing is stuck down, everything is screwed on, everything's labeled like really clearly. It's got QR codes so you can look up where to get replacement parts. You know, they've even made it so that the main board is replaceable. If you want to upgrade to a better CPU in the future, you can take that out completely. You can replace the battery without having to replace other parts. This has cemented this in my brain as this is going to be my next laptop.
Oh,
wow. I looked at it when I think it must have been on this podcast when I heard about it the first time. I looked around and it does look really good. It really, it looks like it's going to satisfy that itch that people have of taking things apart and putting them back together again.
Yeah, and not throwing it away when something breaks. The thing is, when we first spoke about it, I saw the customizable ports and I thought, oh, that looks quite cool. You know, you can swap bits out and you can have it set up exactly how you want. But now I've seen this, that is the least interesting thing about it for me. Like, that's like a little nice add-on feature. But the thing about it for me is the fact that, you know, if you get one of these, theoretically, you never need to buy a new laptop because you can always just replace and upgrade the parts.
The modular ports, I think, is interesting in terms of, like, if I'm going to a conference and I know I'm going to be doing presenting, I'll make sure I've got the HDMI one in.
Yes.
So that I don't need to carry around any dongles because, you know, every conference has an HDMI cable, right? But if I'm going around a mate's house and we want to plug some things in to do some Arduino programming, or we're going to do some, or go to a hacker event or something, I want lots of USB ports in order to plug in like devices to charge them or to power external things. I like the fact that I could plug the things in before I leave the house. I think it loses something if you carry the laptop and you have a bunch of dongles in the bag with it. It's great and very flexible. I feel like you want to prepare before you leave for the event that you're going to, but the flexibility of changing it if you want to. But I agree, it would be lovely if they did manage to sustain the business long enough that they could make next generation motherboards that fit directly in the same thing. That would be amazing.
I'd love it to be widely, and I mean, obviously I would, but I'd love it to be widely successful and this kind of thing take off and everything becomes like this. Cause I read a lot of like sci-fi novels and books like that where hundreds of years in the future and people have completely interchangeable spaceships. And I want this to be the start of that. You know, I want us to go from interchangeable laptops to interchangeable spaceships.
Okay. And on that bombshell, that's all for the news. And that's all for this week. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week where we'll learn more about what Reese does on a daily basis.
Hello.
Listen out for that. That's him. See you next time. Bye-bye.